This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon. Excuse me. Try that again. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Tuesday, time to talk politics, and there's plenty, especially at the federal level. Well, yesterday, the Prime Minister announced a billion-dollar school food program that's mostly getting good reviews, but a lot of people think it should be means-tested. And it comes a few days after we heard about his new renter's bill of rights, that a measure that has largely been mocked. And it's obviously an attempt to win back younger voters who appear to be flocking to Pierre Poilievre. Also yesterday, the carbon tax kicked in, the carbon tax increase, I should say, kicked in, making just about everything more expensive, while the government is telling us that most people will get more back in rebates. All of this while the cost of living salary hikes for parliamentarians also kicked in with a hefty 4.4% increase for MPs, cabinet ministers, and the prime minister. So now an MP has a base salary well over $200,000. I think it's $201,300, something like that. Nice work. And the next election date has been moved forward by a week, and that is a very pension-friendly move for a lot of those MPs. We'll drill down on that. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740.
And now, the Recovering Politicians Panel.
And now I'd like to welcome George Smitherman, former Ontario Liberal Deputy Premier and Minister of Health, Lisa Raitt, former Deputy Leader of the Conservative Party of Canada, and Sherry DeNovo, a former Ontario NDP MPP. Hello and welcome to all of you.
Great to be here, Libby.
So, the pre-budget, I would say, campaign-style tour of the Prime Minister, how's it going, George?
Well, it's pretty clear that the Prime Minister picked up the pace, and I think even before he was rolling out some of the goodies from the budget, he was already on a very active Canada-wide tour. And, you know, I have to say, obviously, the fortunes of the party are not great. We've spoken about that every week, I'm pretty sure. But at the same time, they're using all the power that is available to them as the government to put their best foot forward. And I think it's going, you know, reasonably well. We'll see if it has any impact in polling. But, you know, I think for Liberals, they could at least see that the leader is out and about and setting the pattern with respect to news. And he's definitely getting all about the country. So, you know, I think it's showing a good level of activism on the part of the government, and that's the best hope that they've got.
Lisa, is it going to work, especially with the younger voters that it seems to be targeted at?
Don't think so. I agree with George. I think that this is what they're doing in terms of trying to get ahead of an issue. I would say, from my partisan view, it smacks a bit of desperation, and it is an attempt just to do as much as possible. But remember, all of this stuff is only possible because of taxpayer dollars. And there's a lot of money being put out the door again to try to solve problems that came about during their time. And I'm hoping that some of it works. I like what I saw in the housing announcement because there's a lot of stuff in there that was in a report that I was lucky enough to be part of. And I think that's positive. But I get concerned when these announcements are being made with no real understanding of how they're going to get implemented or executed. And it can be a case where a promise on a very important topic like hunger and food in schools is more of a a moment to try to stem a downturn, as opposed to getting all the premiers together, figuring out the right way to implement this, and having one big announcement on something as important as that.
Yeah, before I move on to Sherry, on that note, there are people saying it should be means tested, but my understanding is there's not a blueprint for this because it's a provincial responsibility and they've got to work it out, as you said, Lisa, with the provinces. So am I right on that, or is this intended to be universal?
No. This has to go through the provinces. I mean, the three big announcements this week all rely upon implementation by the provinces. And that would be the one on childcare, the one on housing today, and the one again today on food and schools. And you have to have good partnerships to do it. And there's not a really good partnership at the moment right now in the Federation. It's great concerns because I think people are going to get their hopes up. So to answer your first question, is it going to help them? No, it's not going to help them because people will wait for the outcome to happen a year from now. And if it's just an announcement and no real change, they're going to turn on them even harder.
Well, exactly. Sherry, in terms of this food program, it has, as I said, received pretty well good reviews. And unlike most of their programs, they even seem to put an implementation date on it. Usually you have to elect them twice more to get any action.
You're so right, Libby. I mean, that's been the Liberal, process is, lots of promises, but we need another election, two or three, before you'll see any action on any of it. I think the communications that's coming out of Ottawa from the Trudeau camp is just abysmal. I mean, imagine giving MPs a huge raise when most Canadians are suffering to 200,000 plus on April Fool's Day.
I know, and it's no joke.
I mean, one in four children are hungry and need the food. Yes, they do. But again, this is a promise. This is all kind of wing and prayer stuff. I don't think they really get the real question is, so why didn't you do this before? Why are you doing it now? I think of all the Liberal promises from, getting rid of first past the post. Remember, Trudeau said it'd be the last election ever under that system. Pharmacare. These are all Liberal promises we still don't really see.
We're getting a little pharmacare. It's not exactly pharmacare.
I mean, we're getting some drugs, but I mean, it's not really a pharmacare program the way that it was promised to be. Again, a couple of elections, So, I mean, I think people are just very fed up with this, and particularly, the way that the communications around the carbon tax have gone out, which couldn't be worse, could not be worse. Somebody needs to be held to account, and they don't seem to be in the Trudeau government.
But Sherry, how much of this is going to rub off on the NDP and Jagmeet Singh propping up that government?
Well, good question. I guess, from the NDP point of view, the hope is not much.
George, there's another issue that, again, we were talking about here yesterday. In addition to these very hefty 4.4% salary hikes for parliamentarians, and that is pushing the next election date ahead by a week, which means that something like 80 MPs who were elected in 2019 and who are in danger of losing their seat will be eligible for these gold-plated lifetime pensions.
Well, thank goodness for Diwali. I think that the explanation for why they need to change the date is at least a reasonably significant one. I would say this with respect to the pay, obviously, because that's tied to inflation, it was a very significant increase at 4.4%. I would say, however, in contrast, Sherry and I served in the Ontario legislature where they don't increase the pay ever. And since 2008, it's remained exactly the same. And honestly, it's ridiculous. It's proven.
No pension.
Right. I mean, it's proven to be quite ridiculous. So it's true that the compensation nationally is established and it goes up every year, but at least they don't mess with it. Whereas in Ontario, they've turned it into this political game where members of the Ontario legislature really are undercompensated for the 7-day a week job that politics is quite frequently throughout the year. I would just say, like, I realize everyone's griping about, you know, the carbon tax and all of that, but I think that the government at least took this on more forcefully in the last week or two. And I think they've done some good actually in forcing people to go and look at the quarterly checks that they are receiving or quarterly bank transfers to recognize that, that there is something coming. So I think even though that's a very challenging lot, I think that they've slightly improved their communication around that even in the course of the last week or two. And, you know, I think that actually this idea that you have to flow money for food programs through the provinces doesn't recognize that food programs run in a lot of the schools are being done by civil society with very little contribution from the provinces, etc. And I think there will be a lot of uptake that expands the capacity to support food programs in schools. And as a solo parent for many years, I've seen in a lot of school environments the extraordinary value that comes from those types of programs. So I think that's actually going to go come across somewhat better.
Lisa, going back to the explanation, I mean, I would think that telling people that they're going to get back more than they pay on the carbon tax is kind of a hard sell. And if that's the case, you know, why do it?
It is a sell to a certain part of society, no question about it. I don't know if that's a big enough voting block for them. I would say this, that if you're telling a younger person that this essentially this is about taking money from one pocket and giving it and distributing it to other pockets, and if you're in the top 20%, you're not going to get anything back, they're going to view that in a very different lens, and that's not going to be it's not going to make sense to them. So selling it on the basis of the environment is actually better to the younger cohort than it is selling it on the basis of an income distribution. And that's because that doesn't appeal to them. They don't want that. They want to earn what they earn and be independent and autonomous. On the, if I could just go on the issue of the MPs getting raises, I am absolutely outraged. I'm outraged by two things. I'm outraged that it's a 4% increase. I'm outraged that it is on a comparable basis with other elected officials around the world, who is who you should be compared to, not to the private sector in Canada. You should be compared to other places around the world, within the provinces too. It's out of whack. It's number two in the entire world. It's actually ridiculous. And the third thing I would say is moving the election day to ensure that certain people are going to receive a pension, even if they lose on the election day that was originally put in by statute. It is what it is. It's an absolute pandering to those folks who may be thinking about bringing down a government, but no longer want to bring down the government because, quite frankly, they want to keep their, they want to make sure they stick around and get their pension. So I'm not happy at all with the recent moves. And I would advise any political party that they run on the basis that their first budget will freeze MP wages.
Okay. I hope they're listening to take the advice. Sherry, moving along to the province, last week, a week ago today, we got the provincial budget. It had one very nice surprise for older Canadians, and that's $2 billion over 3 years for home care. And on the other side, it had a big deficit, which a lot of conservative type people are not happy about. So what do you make of it? Is it one of those situations where they're trying to please everybody and may please no one?
Yeah, I mean, we got a huge deficit and we didn't get anything for it, I think is the general reaction I'm hearing. We're seeing ERs close. We're not seeing homes being built as promised. We're seeing a highway go through where we, you know, on the green belt still, which Ford promised that he wouldn't touch. We're seeing a spa at, instead of public lands at Ontario Place. I mean, all the obvious things. We're seeing schools still struggling for cash. So, you know, we're seeing money go out, but it doesn't seem to be coming to us in the areas that really count, like healthcare, like education, and like, you know, keeping what is ours, ours. So, yeah, I mean, it was a kind of wah-wah and doesn't solve any of the problems that I think people are having on a day-to-day basis. So, not a success, and is kind of proof yet again that the Conservative Party is not good at handling money and balancing budgets, and they're also not good at funding our social services.
Well, George, you're a former health minister. I mean, I've heard that criticism, but frankly, a lot of stakeholders find some things in this budget they really like. Again, we've been talking about how most people want to age in place, to age at home, and there's not enough home care, and this seems like a lot of money as long as it's spent in a reasonable way.
I think that I agree with you that it was a significant contribution on the home care side. There were some new dollars for more primary care teams. These are very important priorities. But the thing that really fascinates and frustrates me about Ontario with respect to health care is that it's got a real, and this is not of one political party, it's built into the culture at Queen's Park and government, is this what I call starve and surge model. So you're seeing increases to home care. We saw recently some announcements about primary care. Those sometimes follow periods where funds have been frozen for a decade, at least on the primary care side. No expansion of teams until they recently put out $110 million, which is quite paltry. Now they're going to put another $500 million in. That's to bring on more allied health professionals around doctors who are leaving comprehensive family practice in Ontario in droves. So I think, yes, there are some things you could point to, but elsewhere in healthcare, there are complete stall outs where even recognition of inflation for employees is not captured. So within the healthcare, where you've got 500,000 people employed, broadly speaking, by the broad public sector, you've got some people that have been frozen pay for 6, 8, and 10 years, and other people that are receiving increases, for instance, because they're in the hospital environment. So I think there are still some really tremendous inequities there. I would just say quickly also that the Ford government's budget, I think, is proof positive or proof negative that they're really creating a fiscal challenge by all these giveaways. I do not need Doug Ford to give me $7 or $8 or $10 back from my monthly hydro bill. Put all of the support that's necessary on people suffering from energy poverty, but let's stop with the fiscal subsidies from our budget. And similarly, not charging people for registrations and all of that seems popular, but at a point in time when it's depriving the provincial government of $5, $6, $8 billion a year, you can see that when the tax revenues slow down, the budget deficit really, really explodes.
Okay, Lisa, you know, this gives us an opportunity to talk about caregiving, and it is National Caregivers Day, and you, of course, are a caregiver for your husband. So what are your thoughts? Most caregivers, of course, are A, unpaid, and B, women.
Well, they are. And in fact, Stats Canada today did a report, and they're talking about what they call sandwich caregivers. So it's the folks who are both looking after kids under 15 and somebody, probably a parent, who is reliant upon them as well. So two things I found of interest is that 30% of caregivers are looking after somebody who is in the parent category, for example. And that to me is just going to go up and up and up. That's just something that is going to increase as the demographic increases. And on average, it costs people about $30,000 a year in lost income. So to say it's unpaid caregiving that impacts our economic productivity, it impacts people's ability to move forward in their careers. And there's really no, I would say, great policy plan figured out on how to deal with this as it marches on, Libby. So I'm just kind of signing an alarm. I appreciate us talking about it today because I think everyone just sort of thinks, well, this is something we go through when we get older. Folks, it's a lot more than you expect and anticipate, and it has a real economic impact on the country.
Well, yeah, but the other economic impact is all that, I forget, I think a number that I've seen in the past is that the unpaid caregiving is worth, I think, $8 billion. It's a lot of money, and it saves the system all that money. So that's the other side of it. I mean, imagine we've been talking about strapped healthcare budgets, and it's interesting that George brought up the surge and starve equation. But, you know, imagine if all of that had to be paid caregiving. And, you know, frankly, with all the money in the world, Lisa, I don't know how easy it's going to be to fill all these jobs that we need.
I agree with you 100%. And it's about trying to, first of all, figure out which is the best way to approach it and recognize it. But I would also say, Libby, that predominantly, and statistics still show it, it's women who are carrying the burden on all this. And as a result, we fall further and further back in the workplace. So, you know, I know it's an impact that we actually have to have our eyes wide open on to try to figure out what's the best way to deal with it.
Okay, I'm going to give the numbers out again, people. We have a few minutes left in this segment. And whether you have yesterday, we were talking about the MP increases and the pension thing, and people were not happy about it. And also caregiving. If you're a caregiver, it's National Caregiving Day, National Caregivers Day. And, I hope someone is celebrating you, because that is a very tough, unpaid job in most cases. 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740. And still on caregiving, again, Sherry, I mean, this $2 billion in the provincial budget for home care, you know, people are saying that's a good thing, and it may ease the burden on those unpaid caregivers.
Well, it may help, but, you know, when I was in Sweden on a parliamentary trip and I was serving, they had, and I don't know if they still have it, an incredible program that would solve this problem. What they would do is, if you were an unpaid caregiver who was looking after someone, they would basically pay you a salary. You would be trained and you would be supervised with a traveling supervisor, and actually even part of a union. And this, they found, saved money from the high cost of institutionalizing folks. So instead of folk being sent to a long-term care facility, which was incredibly expensive, you pay the caregiver to do what they're doing anyway, and you just train them and you give them some support. And they were finding that this worked, in fact, to save money overall for the system. So I just put that out there because I was so, you know, knocked out by that. I thought, what a brilliant idea, and we should definitely have it here.
And Lisa, just to wrap things up on that note, do you think, are there tax breaks for caregivers, that additional tax breaks anyway, that you think would be helpful?
Oh, always. I mean, anything that's going to allow the taxpayer to have more money in order to bring in somebody to help you around the house is going to improve your quality of life without a question, and help on the finances associated with having somebody that you look after. What you receive from Revenue Canada is not significant to a lot of people. Going after the disability tax credit is onerous. It has a lot of hurdles to it. And I'll give you just a truth example. Every 3 years, I get a request from CRA to prove that my husband has been cured from Alzheimer's in order to qualify for his disability tax credit. That stuff is insane, and you can't believe it happens, but it does.
Okay. I hate to wrap things up on such a negative note, but I am looking at the clock, and it's time to do that. Thank you so much, Sherry DeNovo, George Smitherman, and Lisa Raitt, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks a lot.
Always a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay, we are taking a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to the head of the Toronto Police Association. Yesterday, pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas demonstrators were accusing them of excessive force. And on the other side, police have been criticized for not enforcing the law often enough. So we'll have that conversation when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Yesterday, pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas demonstrators accused police of using excessive force on the weekend. And that is a charge that the police vociferously denied. There's also been criticism of police on the other side. People say that they have not taken enough action against protesters who break the law, block infrastructure, and target and intimidate Jewish communities. Well, I talked with Toronto Police Association President John Reed earlier this morning. John Reed, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me today.
Yesterday, these pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas groups spent a lot of time accusing the police of use of excessive force. What's your response to that?
Actually kind of shocked, quite honestly. I think our members have been extremely patient throughout these protests. And keeping in mind now, these protests have been running now for almost 6 months. And, you know, they're in the numbers of the hundreds of protests. And we have found our membership and the service, that unfortunately these are getting more aggressive, you know, as far as on the part of the protesters. And we're into the situation now where our members are trying to manage these safely, because that's their job, is to come and manage these protests safely. So our members do each everything they can to try and ensure that takes place. You know, and they're there to protect people's right to protest. And how they become the brunt of a lot of these comments, particularly you know, when they're standing on the line, I have no idea.
So you've mentioned that the police have been very patient. Now, there's been criticism on the other side that the police are not doing enough to stop harassment by the protesters. But do you think it's possible that the protesters were so shocked by this because basically they've gotten away with assaulting people, with harassing people, targeting Jewish neighborhoods? At the very least, it was a long time between these incidents and any charges. Do you think that's part of what led to what happened?
No, I think we're, you know, our officers are out there. They will proceed. They will ask people to move. They'll be respectful with people. At a certain point, if people commit criminal offenses, they will actually be arrested at that time or at a later time. You know, it's not always an opportune time to an effective arrest unless there's an immediate threat of bodily harm or death. You know, that's a decision which is made on the ground by the officers there. And I would never, you know, second guess the officers.
Have you been looking at greater enforcement of some of the problems, some of the illegal acts by protesters, again, blocking access to hospitals or highways, targeting Jewish communities, and even assault?
But I think the chief has already been clear that people, if they are committing criminal acts, will be arrested. If you're blocking infrastructure and blocking roads, you know, particularly when people are trying to get to hospitals or we're trying to have emergency responses, vehicles get through to places, that is an issue. And then the police will act accordingly.
You've said that these protests are growing more aggressive and violent. Can you please give me some details on that?
Yeah, as an example, so at this protest recently over the weekend there, you know, we had people throwing you know, horse feces at officers. Another officer was, I believe someone attempted to spear an officer with a flagpole. And then during the course of some of these arrests, we then had some additional protesters come in and try and interfere with the lawful arrest of these individuals. And I think that at that point, people have to understand there are many avenues, if you don't agree with an arrest, to be taken up after the fact. But going and trying to grab and interfere with an arrest is an arrestable offense. And accordingly, you will get arrested.
Is there any reason that you believe that these protests are getting so much more aggressive?
I really don't know why people are, I guess people are frustrated. But once again, I'd like to point out that the members, our members, are out there doing their job, preserving their right to ensure that they can protest safely. Our members are not the ones making decisions what goes on in the Middle East. All we're doing is being responsible for looking after their safety here in Toronto. And I really think they need to really have a good thought about that and understand our men and women are doing the job they're supposed to do. and they should not be treated differently. They shouldn't be treated unfairly. They shouldn't be screamed at by these people just for doing their job.
And do you think you have enough resources to handle these protests? Are there enough officers deployed for this?
I think certainly over the weekend we had enough resources. You saw the mounted unit was also there, and that's an amazing unit, particularly with large crowds like this when they get unruly, to assist with crowd control. And I will remind everybody, those horses and the horse riders are experts at what they do, and they always look at public safety and all their interactions with the public.
Okay. John Reed, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Okay, well, we are taking another break, and huge developments in Israel and the Middle East in the conduct of the war and internal developments. We'll talk about that when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Meanwhile, there are huge developments on the ground in Israel and the Middle East. Inside Israel, the largest anti-government demonstrations since October the 7th, and they're now in Jerusalem, which they weren't before. A majority of Israelis want elections and want to replace Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and there is one internal issue that does threaten his right-wing coalition. Now, in the theater of war, Israel has acknowledged that what it calls an unintended IDF strike killed seven World Food Kitchen workers, including a dual Canadian-American citizen. And Israel is not commenting on reports that it is behind a strike or was behind a strike on an Iranian consulate in Syria that killed seven military officers, including some very senior ones. So the numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll-free 1-866-740-4740. And now I'm joined by Jonathan Conricus, the former spokesman for the IDF, Vivian Berkovich, a Canadian lawyer and academic and former ambassador of Canada to Israel, and Uriel Abulov, a senior lecturer at Tel Aviv University's Department of Political Science. Thank you and welcome to you all. Hello.
Thank you. Shalom.
Shalom. I'd like to begin with Uriel, because I believe you are just coming from one of those demonstrations now.
Yeah. I just returned right now. There is an ongoing demonstration in a sort of a tent city that has been established in Jerusalem in an attempt to try and persuade the government to step down and allow for an immediate election.
And how big is this demonstration? I gather it's in Jerusalem, and that's kind of new, having these big demos in Jerusalem.
No, not at all new, because this is what we've had for about 9 months before the massacre of October 7, many of those demonstrations took place in Jerusalem, which is a fitting place, obviously. This is the seat of the government. It's the capital of Israel. And now we are renewing the demonstration. It has been going on in Tel Aviv, in Jerusalem, and other cities countrywide. But now the effort this week is to concentrate those demonstrations in Jerusalem before the Knesset is basically taking its break.
And when that's a Passover break, that'll be in April, right?
This is going to start this Thursday, and it's going to last for a couple of months. And what we are urging everyone in the Knesset, and not least the current coalition, is to realize that what the Israeli public demands overwhelmingly is for an immediate election as soon as possible in order to have a better coalition, a better government, a better prime minister than what we've had over the past year and a half.
Jonathan Conricus, a former IDF spokesman. We saw very quickly today that the IDF did take responsibility for that strike that killed those aid workers working for the World Food Kitchen. The IDF spokesman called José Andrés, who is the founder, But still, here in Canada, our foreign minister has condemned the strike. What do you think the impact of it will be?
Yes. Hi. Thank you for having me. It's a very sensitive time. The real importance, other than, of course, the sad loss of life of people who came to Gaza to do good for other people, these humanitarian workers who, of course, are worthy of our respect, and my condolences go on to the families as well. But the real strategic thing here happening is that the day after in Gaza, and actually today in Gaza, the biggest and most burning issue is how can food and humanitarian aid be provided to those who really need it. Not those that are the strongest and have weapons and military backing, like Hamas and Islamic Jihad, who take the humanitarian aid, but those who actually need it, the women, the children, the elderly, and other people. And that's the biggest challenge, because there's lots of humanitarian aid coming into Gaza, but then the problem is with the distribution. And the World Kitchen Organization was... I think that Israel was trying to circumvent the current blocks that exist with getting help by the World Kitchen Organization. And therefore, I think it's double sad, doubly tragic that this sad event happened today, because it really, it's a wrench in the wheel or a wrench in the machinery. And, you know, the organization said that they are now suspending operations, which is, of course, would be very dangerous for lots of Palestinians who really acutely need the food here. And really what's at stake here is the current ability to provide food to Palestinians in need, and how the day after fighting in Gaza will look like, where every humanitarian organization that is positively inclined and really is there for humanitarian purposes, unlike UNRWA and many organizations who are there but have failed the Palestinians and their humanitarian needs, every one of those organizations will be needed, and Israel will have to be responsible to make sure and to be extra, super careful that this never happens again, because once is a mistake and it probably can be eventually tolerated. But at the end of the day, I don't think that Israel can or has enough, you know, international diplomatic currency, so to say, to go through this again.
Vivian Berkovich, so the World Food Kitchen has suspended aid in Gaza. I just saw an alert that so has the UAE, which will, I would imagine, getting aid in much more complicated, and Israel is under pressure to make that happen. What's your view of that?
I wasn't aware that an alert just went out about the UAE suspending food. I assume that that means food shipments.
Yeah.
But the UAE wasn't involved in distribution internally within the Gaza Strip. And what that would signal to me is that before sending anything, they would likely want to be extra sure, careful, certain that there is a reliable and responsible mechanism to distribute the food operationally within the Gaza Strip. I'm not sure that we can read much more into that. They're not, the UAE is not going to withhold food that is desperately needed by people in the Gaza Strip. That, I think, is a given. It's more about, as Lieutenant Colonel Conrico said, is once it arrives at the border, getting it to the people who need it.
But again, what do you see as the impact of this on the whole situation? As I said, here in Canada, Foreign Minister Melanie Joly condemned this airstrike. Does it put Israel in a worse position?
Well, it certainly doesn't put Israel in a better position. I mean, it's horrible. I think that the two... Kornikos and your previous speaker, addressed that issue quite well. It's a very delicate time. It's a horrific time, and it's a tragic mistake. There's no one's celebrating what happened. Does it put Israel in a more difficult position? It certainly increases the international scrutiny and pressure. With respect to Minister of Foreign Affairs Melanie Joly, I don't read much into her comment. She is always quick to jump on anything where Israel is or may be implicated. She has jumped on occasions in the past where the issue that she condemned turned out to be a rumor, completely untrue. So she has this reflexive response to anything that involves Israel, and I'll let that sort of speak for itself. And Canada, I think, is important. But, you know, I think that the way in which countries like Germany, France, the UK and the US react are going to be much more telling. And let's not forget that in war theaters, tragic mistakes happen. And I think we all remember there was one horrific error involved the United States and Afghanistan, where there were scores who were killed in a hospital hit. A totally inadvertent, tragic, terrible mistake for which the U.S. appropriately apologized. And these things happen, and it's terrible.
Uriel Aboulof, I don't want to get into the weeds on this question, but can we get a kind of a clear explanation that you're talking about elections? The government doesn't want elections. However, there is one internal issue that is very threatening to this government, and that is the issue of drafting ultra-Orthodox men who now have basically blanket exemptions, and those exemptions presumably expired yesterday, I think, because of a Supreme Court ruling. So can you explain simply what's going on with that and whether you think that it can explode the coalition?
Well, simply put, the Supreme Court ruled that the government should act now to draft the ultra-Orthodox, and if it does not, it should halt all payment to the yeshivas. But that only applied to the past half a year, which means that the monetary loss for the ultra-Orthodox is relatively minor, and they will be able to compensate for that through various dealings in the coalition itself. So to the latter part of your question, I don't think that this is a substantial challenge to the current coalition. As long as they have 64, or for that matter, 61 members of Knesset who are willing to keep on doing what they've been doing, the coalition is stable, and that is, of course, the major cause that people are taking to the streets, trying to put some public pressure on the government.
But on the other side, secular members of the coalition, like Benny Gantz, have said that if the government doesn't implement it, they will leave the coalition.
Well, right. We can certainly see a scenario that Gantz and Eisenkot will be leaving the coalition, but bear in mind they are not part of the core coalition. They're only there for the war period, and even if they go, we still have the 64 members of Knesset who brought us to this point in time, this devastating, horrible point in time. And as long as they stick to their chairs and prefer their own political and personal power over the interests of the Israeli public and beyond that of the region, we will continue to see those sides. And I think that we will continue to go to that downward spiral.
Jonathan Conricus, do you agree that this is not a threat to the coalition or a big threat?
Yeah, I'm less involved in political affairs. I usually deal with security, but since this is also a security-related issue, I can comment on it. And a very good political commentator said a few days ago that usually governments in Israel are elected based on their security, foreign policy, and security agenda. Usually they fall as a result of internal domestic issues. Number one issue over the years has been this thorny long-term injustice of what we call who actually carries the burden. How do we share the burden in Israeli society? Who serves and who, for whatever historical obscenities, is exempt from service. I hope, as a citizen, as a former IDF officer, as a father of four kids who will serve in the IDF, I personally hope that everybody will serve, that everybody will serve the country as proud patriots, because we need all hands on deck. Maybe not everybody can serve in the military, maybe in other services they can do other types of contributions to the country, but the military needs more men, more able men and women, and there's definitely a lot of work to go around. So I hope, and I want to remain optimistic, that our political system will for once do what's right and not what is politically convenient, and finally create some justice in Israeli society on this long...
Vivian, what's your view of that?
So I think that it's a crisis. It's not an immediate crisis, as in, you know, because of the Supreme Court ruling, the government will, you know, fall tomorrow. over the course of the next 12 to 18 months, I agree that it's going to be the domestic issue that undoes this government. And I agree with Conricus totally that it should undo the government. I want to point out one important point that is, you mentioned in your intro that, you know, it's a religious issue, that it is religious people who are exempted, which is true. The ultra-Orthodox are. But the anger and the rancor over the abuse of this exemption, which was granted historically for all kinds of reasons and has completely been distorted to the point that it's grotesque, the inequity that it creates in society. And the anger over that is really found across society among religious Israelis, non-religious, traditional. We've kind of... we're into a new sort of environment now because of this war. And so when the time comes that we do go to elections, I expect and hope that we will have a very differently constituted government. And a lot of it will be because of this issue.
Well, I mean, I would think that the issue is even more urgent because Israel is in a war and there are a lot of soldiers who've been killed. They need,
and there's absolutely, and look, the issue extends not just beyond the draft and serving; it also extends towards, you know, working and contributing to the economy. And you're absolutely right; it is urgent, and we all feel the urgency. Having said that, it's just such an entrenched system that it simply cannot be undone overnight.
Back to security issues. We also had this strike in Syria. The New York Times is reporting that some Israeli officials confirmed that Israel was behind it. Israeli authorities have said that, well, that consulate in an embassy complex, it wasn't an embassy or a consulate. It was a place where the Revolutionary Guard and other factions from Iran were operating. Do you see an escalation in that, Jonathan Conricus?
Well, actually, the escalation was done a long time ago when Iranian proxies started butchering Israeli civilians. The escalation was October the 7th. And I only regret that it took Israel so long to do the absolutely necessary and to bring back, let's say, to return to sender to the Iranians what's been going on. Had it not been for Iranian money, arms, political guidance, and extremism, we would not be in war now. There wouldn't be 2 million Palestinian refugees, and there wouldn't be 200,000 Israeli refugees, and we wouldn't be talking about the sad killing of aid workers either. We would perhaps not be having the interview, or we would be discussing Israeli high-tech, agri-tech, or otherwise technological advances in Israel, which would be the news. But the fact of the matter is that Iran exports terror in the Middle East. And for once, Israel decided not to continue to talk with the messenger, but actually take the business back to the sender. And I think not a moment too soon. And eventually, in order for violence to stop in the Middle East, what needs to happen is for the Iranians to understand that the price of them continuing to spread violence, instability, and extremism in the Middle East, that the price for them, for the Iranians, in Iranian assets, in Iranian blood, will be too high. Only when the Iranians will understand it, then will the security situation in the Middle East end. And I think that there are only two countries that can bring about that understanding in Iran. One of them is my country, Israel, and the second is the U.S.
Well, speaking of the U.S., Uriel, Netanyahu has, I don't know what the right word is, ignored some of the demands by the Americans. There are increasing calls in the United States for them to take action against this government. How is this divide being viewed in the country, and what do you make of it?
Yeah, I think ignoring what the administration has been saying is a sort of an understatement in this context. Both Netanyahu and his coalition and many other people in the media, Israeli media, who belong to that camp as effectively being mocking Biden, although they should be extremely grateful for all the help that Biden has been offering Israel over nearly half a year now in its struggle. Now, the thing is that the current government does not have a geopolitical strategy for the day after. They would not like to see a day after, especially Netanyahu, who would like to see the war lingering. And it is possible that the escalation in the north is part of that. Now, Israel direly needs the U.S. on its side in fighting against Hezbollah and Iran. And there is no way to go about it without also addressing the Palestinian issue, which is something that Netanyahu and his government has been trying to avoid in every way possible. Unless you count those extreme messianic elements in the government wanting basically to control all the land from the river to the sea as a sort of strategy. And we are stuck at that point without a real substantial coalition, not just between Israel and the U.S., but other moderate powers in the world and in the region itself. And there are such moderate powers. Israel is looking towards a very dire future, I'm afraid.
Very quickly, last words to Vivian. What's your view about this growing rift between Israel and the United States?
Deep concern. I mean, I share the view. The truth is, those of us who aren't actually in the room never understand what's actually and really going on. But I think it's fair to assume that it's pretty fundamental. I think we've been very fortunate up to now to have what I consider to be a very steadfast ally in President Biden and in Secretary Blinken. But they made it clear in the last UN vote when the U.S. abstained that they're being pushed way too far. And somebody here needs to give their head a really hard shake and develop a more sober and helpful approach to these issues. It's not good.
It's not good. I think that sums up what is going on now. Let's hope for better days ahead. Thank you so much, Vivian Berkovich, Uriel Abulov, and Jonathan Conricus. Very interesting conversation. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Libby. Bye-bye.
And that is all the time we have for today. Jane Brown will be in the chair tomorrow. I'll be back on Thursday.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.